The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
the beast.
We're told in the book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan! Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
From the sunny heartland of America, I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to our humble bunker, everybody. It's been a long time since we've been here.
Yeah, it's been a busy spring for us here in the bunker. And
Have we done an April show?
A couple of View from the Bunker interviews, but we've not done a PID radio.
Where have we been?
Well, we were at the conference in Chicago, which was right at the end of March, beginning of April.
That's true.
And then the following weekend, I was at another conference of sorts, a bunch of guys singing in four-part harmony, and that was took up a lot of time. There have been some changes at work that have involved shifting around some territories, and so some
we've
extra
had
work
that
on
going
side,
on, and we've also had the great flood of 2013.
Yeah, well, sort of the micro flood of 2013 in the macro
great to
sense,
us.
But it was pretty great to us. It wasn't very great. It was actually pretty awful.
It was pretty awful. The awful flood of 2013. Yeah. Our basement flooded. Every floor covering down there has to be replaced, and a vanity.
Yeah, all is vanity.
We'll just throw that on the bonfire.
So it says in Ecclesiastes. Anyway, welcome to PID Radio. But, you know, all things considered, we got no problems.
We're still here.
Yeah, none of the furniture was damaged. None of the personal belongings were damaged.
We're the soggy bottom kids.
That's right, we were. I was.
After going around the floor
and removing the...
You did have a soggy bottom,
the baseboard,
honey,
there for the carpeting guys. Yeah, I was the soggy bottom guy. So anyway, but again, no big deal. We're back.
We're thankful to the Lord that we are here. And you know what?
So today is April 29th of 2013. We're glad to report that here in the state of Illinois, the drought is officially over.
Praise God.
Yeah, you get 5 inches of rain in a day, and the farmers are like, well, okay, it would have been nice to spread that out a little. The average for the state of Illinois in the month of April is 6.5 inches, at least our part of Illinois. And we got 5.5 in one day.
Yeah.
So,
but and all of it was in the basement.
Yeah. No, we called it Lake Sam.
Sam says, leave me out of this.
I'm not to blame.
Just go away.
A lot of things going on in the world. Well, first of all, we probably should talk about the conference, the Chicago Summit 3.
Wasn't that a wonderful, I mean, I can't think of when I've had a better time. At least not this year.
other than just
the times being with you, because you're so cute. We had a really good time. Lots of Russ Dizdar, of course.
Yeah, L.A. Marzulli,
Rob Skiba. Yep, the Skibas were there. Mm-hmm. And of course, Russ Dizdar's better half, so to speak,
yes,
Shelley Dizdar, she was there. She had a wonderful presentation on, frankly, what Planned Parenthood is really all about.
Yeah, money.
Yeah.
Basically, it is a for-profit organization that somehow managed to get itself classified as a public health service.
You're sort of going left and right on my ears, honey. How are you doing that?
I'm not sure if this is the... I wonder if it's just our headphone connection there.
It could be, but every time
it's
you...
It's crackling. Yeah, it's not crackling on the VU
meters.
No, that's
okay,
here, so.
But it is in my headphones. And that's okay, because I know you're there. I'm going to close my eyes, though. Is he there? I don't know. Oh, he is! He's still there!
We've been watching some strange things on Netflix in recent weeks, so please forgive us.
Three hams will thrill.
Oh, Mr. Giggles.
Anyway. The summit was a really wonderful gathering, and I think it was just as enjoyable at the meals as we were able to sit down, break bread, and share thoughts and ideas and... With other people that we were eating with, mm-hmm. and some folks that we've known, and new friends that we made while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Taylor Kent and his wife, Taylor, otherwise known as the Snarky Avenger.
Came down from Minnesota. That's not a new friend. That's an old friend.
Well, I know, but we haven't seen him in quite some time. In fact, it was two bunkers ago that we last saw him. Three bunkers ago.
We're starting. We're starting to keep time based on bunkers.
How many bunkers?
Let's say it was tickety five bunkers ago.
Yeah. So that was a lot of fun. And then, and, you know, the
Doug Woodward was there. I hate to start naming names because I know I'll leave somebody out. But we had such a good time.
Doug Hamp.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. And of course, the topic was near and dear to my heart.
Right.
It was all about deoxyribose nucleic acid DNA, and lots of information coming from different disciplines about how DNA is so important.
It is the code by through which God created a life on this earth. It's the mechanism through which life, I don't want to use a computer analogy because that's essentially what the transhumanists want to do. Just boil humanity down to hardware and software.
Yeah.
With the software being the brain patterns, the engrams or whatever, the electrical activity that takes place inside of your head, which they believe they can replicate and then upload into a hardware, a substrate of some sort, a computer hard drive or processor, and eventually preserve life to the point of immortality. But it is more than that. You cannot replicate in a machine the human soul.
No, no. Well, Lawnmower Man, he got evil when he went into the computer.
Yeah. Well, and Dr. Hugo de Garris, who has written the book The Artelect War, who's been quoted by Tom Horn numerous presentations. I was fortunate to have had the opportunity to speak with Dr. de Garris, and we'll probably do so again. It was a very enjoyable conversation, I think, for both of us, and very educational, and someone who specializes, whose field of expertise is artificial intelligence, who says that that those who believe we can create an AI that is so powerful that it is indistinguishable and then merge human intelligence with it are like little kids playing with fire.
Yes.
And he's written a recent piece, which I've not read. I just read the headline and a couple of snippets from it. But it's consistent with what he was telling me in the interview that we had last fall, which was that he believes that this the idea of creating a human-machine interface leading to an artificial intelligence or an artificially enhanced human intelligence is going to be the biggest political issue of the 21st century. And he believes ultimately it will result in a war for survival.
The Artelect War.
The Artelect War. And Artelect being a term that he coined to refer to artificial intellect. And a war between Artelects and what he called cosmists and Terrans, the cosmists believing that we can, you know, like Dr. Raymond Kurzweil, that we're ultimately moving towards a unification of humanity with the cosmos, and Terrans, those of us who believe we should not tinker with God's design.
Luddites.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why they'll see us. And I think that's funny because in the room we're in right now, we can look around and count more than a dozen internet-enabled devices.
And that includes Sam.
Yes. He's surfing the web with his eyes closed.
I know.
Lawnmower dog. So, but the...
if only.
he believes that it will result in what he called... he actually called it giga death. You know, billions of deaths. As this artificially enhanced intelligence or intelligences look down upon us the way we look down upon the ants that find their way into our kitchen. You're a nuisance. You're nothing.
Squish.
You're a useless eater, Squish. And that's how there is nothing that means that artificially enhancing or creating an artificially enhanced super intelligence means that is also going to be just and good and compassionate. Like I said, they may well look upon us the same way we look on the insect invaders that managed to come through the
If we serve them in any way, we'll be, you know,
useful,
so they
I
can
suppose.
Bet on us. You know, I'll wager 30 quetlus on the nuclear.
And we could be like sand kings.
Great short story if you have never read
George R. R. Martin, many, many years before The Song of Ice and Fire. So Game of Thrones. But no, that was essentially the topic of discussion And of course, the speakers at the conference were all on the side of, look, you know, this is how God designed humanity. DNA is the source code, if you will, but we shouldn't tinker with it because there's more that it's not just an engineering problem that goes into figuring out how, you know, what it does and how we can tinker with it. It's more than that. There is a divine design at work there.
It goes far deeper than that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think one of the coolest things for me is that among all of the speakers, I don't know that there was really any repetitions, you know, so to speak.
No.
We actually enhanced each other.
Mm-hmm.
We were enhanced.
Well, I think that the presentations dovetailed very
they
nicely.
They did,
and
exactly.
You saw
me doing that with my fingers,
yes.
And yet the word enhanced came out. So who's running my mouth, huh? Sam.
Yeah. Under the binky, just kind of sitting there grinning. But it was almost as though there was a divine hand sort of guiding the presentations.
It really did feel that way. And you know, it's that idea of being part of the body, mm-hmm. that everybody has his or her own job to do. And
right. And
we each presented our own portion of, you know, a big overarching story.
Mm-hmm. There were some presentations that dealt with the Nephilim and the role that they mm-hmm. may have played and may yet play in human history.
Right.
My presentation was a little different. It kind of focused on the use of technology in a sort of scientistic reimagining of the end times.
Mm-hmm.
And I even suggested, and I didn't beat the point, didn't really belabor the point because I wasn't there to just cause controversy for its own sake, but just I just raised the question, you know, what if the entire issue of the return of the Nephilim is nothing more than a red herring to distract us from what's happening under our nose?
It's a valid question.
Yeah. So, you know, I am willing to, and we mm-hmm. on PID Radio and A View from the Bunker are willing to give voice to those who are who believe that the Nephilim yet have some role to play,
mm-hmm.
Because it does seem to have some, borrowing a phrase from Mike Heiser, explanatory power for what's going on in genetics labs around the world.
Exactly.
But what if Nephilim doesn't just mean a giant? What if Nephilim means a human hybrid of any sort?
Right.
What if, you know, whether it's genetically through genetic tampering or through technological enhancement? I saw an article in the paper today where they are getting closer and closer to computer brain interfaces, which has some that technology has some medical benefit.
Oh, it would be wonderful. Can you imagine if you have an artificial arm,
mm-hmm.
to be able to move that arm with your mind? And
right,
they're very
exactly.
close to that.
People who are through either birth defect or through tragic accident have lost the use of their limbs, to be able to maneuver artificial limbs with their mind, yes, would be a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Would be a blessing. But Wesley J. Smith, whom we talked to a number of times, who's been writing on the issue of human exceptionalism, and you can find his blog on this topic, by the way, at the National Review Online, and it is worth looking up, did an article just within the last few days on a disturbing trend out there about how the transhumanist movement is enabling people who have a mental illness in which they believe that their limbs are not really parts of themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm aware of that.
Yeah. I feel like I'm only me down to the, you know, my right knee and the lower leg.
It's a limbic system problem is how they look at it
mm-hmm.
psychologically. And oftentimes it's divided, you know, sagittally along a line. So you right half of the body isn't mine. I don't know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll attempt to throw that person out of the bed and throw themselves out of the bed, which is tragic.
Yes. But
they'll only shave one side of their, you know, his face and things like that.
But instead of dealing with this as a psychological issue, there are those in the transhumanist movement that say, well, why shouldn't this person be allowed to amputate his leg? Yeah, we'll cut it off. We'll replace it with an artificial one, you know, and that person.
But the problem is that they may not think the artificial one. I mean, the limbic system it's a very complicated system within the brain that essentially tells you where everything is in space, but it's much deeper than that. I think they're still trying to figure out what it is.
I'm kind of meandering myself, so forgive me for kind of losing sight of my point here. But the brain computer interface does have some valid, very valid, and potentially very beneficial applications. But there are those who want to take advantage of the technology simply to become way smarter or way better at, say, you know, golf or baseball or, you know, whatever. And, you know, there really is no limit on that. I mean, these are people who are looking at the Star Trek future and saying, you know, why can't I be like Commander Data? You know, I want to be that intelligent and, you know, not be subject to human emotions or what. You know.
But where it's going to end up is the Borg. I mean, they're going to have a human born that is instantly, you know, brought into the fold, so to speak, mm-hmm. part of the hive mind by enhancing him.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to be enhanced, well, you need to be enhanced for your own good or you're useless to us.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the analogy of the human looking down at the ant crawling around in the kitchen sink and thinking, well, you're here eating my stuff and you're not going to squish.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Well, I think we can probably move on to something else because there's lots and lots to talk about.
Much in the news since we last talked.
Well, I think we can actually segue to the big story in the last 10 days, talking about limb replacement, and that is that, you know, there were several people who lost limbs in the Boston Marathon bombing.
Right.
So what do you think? Do you really think it's the Tsarnaev brothers?
Well, I've not done a whole lot of research in it. The thing I was disturbed about along those lines, though, was that the immediate jump by some in the alternate media to the conclusion that it was a false flag event.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
saying it was fake blood and things like that.
There were the extremists who said that this was a bunch of actors. Like, sorry. I mean, we saw the same thing in the wake of the shooting in Watertown, Connecticut as well, by the way. A bunch of actors, mm-hmm. it's faked, it's all staged. There are a lot of people involved there who would need to be really bought off. I mean, I believe that there are conspiracies. It's human nature to be conspiratorial. Heck, you see it in business. You come up with a better way of building a mousetrap. You want to keep it secret from your competitors mm-hmm. before you bring it to market. And you conspire to make those things happen. There are conspiracies all around us. So I'm not much of a coincidence theorist. But when it comes to something like the shootings in Watertown, like the bombing in Boston, to go to that extreme right away, I don't think serves anybody well.
Well, you know, speaking of conspiracies, there are a number of items within this whole story that have come out in the news. One of those memes is that the Tsarnaev family, and that mm-hmm. includes the mother and possibly even the father, not the uncle, because he keeps saying, no, they're stupid, I'm not part of that.
They deserve what they got.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, the Tsarnaev family seems to believe in a lot of what you and I call conspiracy theories, and one of those is that 9/11 was an inside job.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that meme is, if you believe in things like that, if you distrust the mainstream media, if you try to really look behind what you're told and verify the facts, so to speak, then you're a nutcase.
Exactly.
And dangerous.
And that is one of the disturbing consequences of people who immediately jump to the conclusion that this was all fake and start posting things, you know, conclusive proof that this mm-hmm. was staged.
Just bear in mind that some of the people that post that kind of stuff are doing it as their job.
Yes, that's my point. I jumped ahead of you. Yes, that there are those who claim to be on the side of the truth seekers who are there just to make the rest of us who ask any questions at all along these lines look, like you said, mm-hmm. dangerous.
Yeah. Well, you know, in fact, there was a story over, and this is sort of connected, a story that's been reported from over in the UK, a man who calls himself a troll, an internet troll, who goes online and he posts horrific things in the comments sections. You and I have run into that a few times. Was posting a story at a Facebook site of a girl who had, I don't have the story in front of me. I think she had been killed, and he was calling her names. Oh, he was just throwing all sorts of vitriol at her and her reputation, and he didn't know her from anything. And of course, it very much upset her. Her family. It upset. I was trying to think if there was a lawsuit or if anyway he has been tracked down, and his excuse has been, well, that's what I do. I troll the internet. And, you know, I didn't mean anything by it. Wasn't personal. And I think the UK government is planning on going after him. But
sure.
That's the kind of thing that makes true, you know, how do I put this? Skeptics.
Skeptics, yeah.
I think true skeptics, it's starting to paint us with a very broad brush.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that.
No,
I don't want to be painted with a broad brush.
No, I agree.
Nice, narrow, fine line brush.
So, you know, we've asked a lot of questions, and there have been times when we've been on, you know, going back, there are...
we've said some things over the years that
I wish we hadn't questioned at the time because there wasn't really, you know...
or things we've said. Everybody does that.
Sure.
Because we essentially record this live to...
live to hard drive, and we put it out there in the interweb, and it stays
and
there
it is
forever.
What it is.
It is what it is. So, you know, if we make mistakes, you'll find them there. And as we've said many, many times, don't take our word for it. Check how it comports and compares against Scripture. And if it's not in accordance with the Bible, then we're wrong.
Yeah.
Just asking questions. And I get kind of irate about this too when you start hearing mainstream media folks who start. Say, well, anyone who dares even ask the question about where, for example, our president was born is a nutcase and probably dangerous. And there are people out there who are making a pretty good living soliciting funds from people who are afraid of people who ask questions like that.
Yes, but you know
Southern
what?
Poverty Law Center.
We all know the president is no longer nearly as Muslim.
He said so.
As he used to be.
His words, not ours. Oh, brother.
That was at the the White House press corps dinner. You know, speaking
you
of...
You said press whore dinner? I'm sorry.
Press corps.
I'm sorry.
Oh, honey, I wouldn't say that.
A bad word, but
bad
frankly,
word.
I'm... it's.
I know.
It's
well,
accurate.
I know. I think it is.
Yeah.
That you know, they had an awful lot of people at that dinner that had no business being there.
The reason
Tom
I say
Brokaw
that, by the way,
had
just
a
to explain. Yes.
Article about
and he,
that.
And he raised that last year when somebody brought Lindsay Lohan as a guest to the White House mm-hmm. press correspondents dinner. The reason I say that, by the way, just to give you, and forgive me for using the word, I didn't intend to do it just to shock, but the press correspondents had their dinner at the White House, supposedly a fundraiser for charity. They walk out of there with 20 pounds worth of swag in a bag from all sorts of sponsors of this dinner,
mm-hmm.
and it's turned into a Washington Hollywood glam fest.
But the press corps is independent, right?
Yes.
They can't be influenced by anybody.
The fourth branch of government watching out for our interests. No, not so much.
More like the fifth column.
So much, yeah.
Speaking of conspiracy-minded folk that are well-known,
mm-hmm.
Dennis Kucinich today tweeted...
Oh. Yeah.
And I even retweeted it. He says, trying to make sense of what's happening in Syria,
mm-hmm.
Google Syria false flag chemical weapons. Very interesting. More false intelligence.
Yeah. That is a really interesting development. I'm glad you raised that because this is one where you get people on the left and on the right, both on board with this, except for guys like Kucinich. I haven't seen what Ron Paul has had to say about this, but... And understand, please, that I don't think that Ron Paul is the answer to all of America's political ills.
But he generally is, you know,
he's generally
a little bit more skeptical.
Yeah. And on the issue of America's military interventions overseas, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, who are as far apart on the political spectrum as you can get, actually find themselves in agreement. But everyone else, left and right, seems to be on board with the idea that President Assad in Syria has used chemical weapons on his own people. Which means we need to go in with the troops.
Even Nancy Pelosi is saying mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
I don't think she would have said that with George Bush
nope.
in the White House. I just looked at Drudge Report. It is no longer there, but there was a big picture as the headline story of Putin shaking hands with Obama. And essentially it was, you know, war in Syria. Don't quote me on that, but as a paraphrase, because the implication behind the headline was Putin and Obama have agreed that this is where we have to go. We have to take it, you know, and take them out.
Yeah, to the next step, huh? Well, it is a...
And along that same line, there was a story of a Russian passenger jet that was fired upon in Syrian airspace.
Right, right. Which I saw and wondered about the timing of that particular story.
Exactly, from, because it came out at the same time as we saw the Drudge Report Putin-Obama picture.
Right. This story from RT, or Russia Today, before they changed name, rebranded the channel.
Yeah.
But they're reporting that two missiles were allegedly fired at a Russian plane with at least 159 passengers on board over Syrian territory. Russian officials admit that the jet faced danger, but they are not speaking about a targeted attack. The news was broke on Monday. According to an informed source in Moscow.
Monday, as in today.
As in today. So the question is, who fired the missiles? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that Syrian troops fired the missiles. It's very possible, in fact, that other forces on the ground trying to start something shot at the plane.
Let me just jump in here really quickly. If you have not seen the series... The State Within, mm-hmm. watch it.
Yeah, it was produced in 2006, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
For BBC America, a miniseries, Sharon Gless and a British actor whose name I can't remember, but then he was...
Let me look it up here.
He
was also in a series that I just watched, and it was
called
canceled.
Awake, yeah.
Oh, it was so good.
Yeah, in which he plays a cop who suffers a tragic, just a serious car wreck, and then he wakes up... It finds that his son has been killed in the accident, and then he goes to sleep, but immediately wakes up in a different timeline in which his son is alive and his wife is dead. And he goes back and bounces back and forth. We thought he was an American actor until we remembered, wait a minute, wasn't he in that British series where he played the British? He is a Brit. Oh.
Yeah, Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs is the name of the mm-hmm. actor. Wonderfully done. And an interesting plot in this miniseries in which a passenger jet is blown up over Washington, D.C. And as the evidence begins to spin out, the press never really catches on to what's going on, but the insiders inside the Beltway realize what's happening. And what has happened is that a private company with many military contracts mm-hmm. has conspired to start a war on the ground in an Asian land, basically for the benefit of those with military contracts and contracts. And
there's a wonderful disclaimer at the beginning of each episode, essentially saying, and I'm paraphrasing, the companies that you see in this little miniseries have nothing to do with real companies, mm-hmm. corporations, and people. In other words, don't sue us. Yeah. And we could throw in the names of many, many well-known companies. Yeah, Sharon Gless plays a combination of Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
She's the Secretary of Defense. Mm-hmm. She has the former CEO of said company that's, you know, sort of involved in many, many military contracts. Mm-hmm. And she's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we could use somebody like her. I mean, that character.
There are times that I think, yeah. Oh, man, if we only had somebody like that.
Sure. But interesting that they used the name Armitage for the company, mm-hmm. Which was pretty clearly a stand-in for a company like Halliburton or any number of other, you know, DynCorp, maybe, mm-hmm. you know, any number of other well-connected contractors. Yeah, because Armitage is, there was a fellow who was, part of the Washington Insider Group for quite some time named Richard Armitage. Mm-hmm. So it's a name that kind of conveys the message. But as long as they put the disclaimer at the front of the show.
But it has nothing to do with a real person.
Absolutely not. No. You can find it for free download at Netflix and probably Amazon Prime, I would guess. But worth watching. It's informational, interesting in the same way that the movie Syriana.
Yeah. That was the other one that I was going to mm-hmm. mention.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that, well, we're not always told the truth.
Right.
And, yeah, I agree that there are times when the military doesn't need to tell us everything that they're doing.
Absolutely.
And the intelligence that they've gathered, because that's the whole point of spying.
Yeah.
Is that it's secret.
You don't want the public necessarily knowing things that could get soldiers on the ground killed.
But I would rather that there not be a military-industrial complex mm-hmm. that is going about fomenting war
right.
so that we can sell, burgers.
Yeah, in a different line of work, we would call that marketing. We need to sell more bombs. What do we need? Well, we need to get more customers for our bombs. How do we do that? We start a war.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, great.
Marketing.
Okay.
Marketing. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like General Smedley Butler back in the 20s. War is a racket.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, another reason to keep an eye on Syria, because we've been agitating for a war there for a while. And it looked to me last week when the news about the claim of chemical weapons being used in Syria came out, I thought, okay, well, this is what they've said was the what was the word they call it? The red line. Mm-hmm. That Syria has crossed that red line. But then the Obama administration very quickly afterwards said, well, we're not really sure that they crossed the red line, which, of course, then conservative commentators, and conservative is in air quotes, of course, mm-hmm. Started accusing him of going squishy on the whole Syria thing.
Yeah. So is this the red line as defined by the Obama administration or the red line as mm-hmm. defined by Netanyahu? Remember, his red line had to do with Iran.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Don't know.
Well, red lines, red phones.
Yeah. It's...
And red commies over in North Korea jumping up and saying, notice me.
And what happened with that all? Because, you know, we were hearing about how we were on the verge of nuclear war, and suddenly that's quieted down.
Well, except that there was a story today saying that the biggest ever military drill is about to take place in North Korea.
Okay.
And he's saying to people on the demilitarized zone, you better move back. I don't know. I still think that he's trying to make a name for himself, and he would be very foolish if he truly did attack the big dog.
Yeah, and I don't think I've said before, I don't think the Chinese would appreciate it.
No,
I really think the Chinese would rein him in. North Korea is a useful junkyard dog for China, but not if it brings animal control around with thermonuclear devices. Yeah,
I'm sorry. I just was thinking of the dog that was on the Coal Shack episode that we were watching this afternoon. The one with the
big
pentagram around his neck.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Not that kind of junkyard dog.
There's a lot of stuff to keep an eye out on. And it can be really depressing. I mean, the Telegraph, by the way, is reporting today that there's a battle taking place between Syrian troops and Al-Qaeda forces who... incidentally, through the rebel forces, we are probably arming because many of the much of the opposition or some of the opposition to President Assad in Syria is Al-Qaeda.
Well, that's another meme that's been out there about the marathon bombers is that it was done in the Al-Qaeda style.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, got to keep that bogeyman up there so that we're afraid. And, you know, and just to finish my point, the point being that, you know, if we arm the rebels, which, you know, that drum has been beaten by American senators like John McCain for a while now. You know, we're putting, as we did in Egypt, where we put the Muslim Brotherhood in power, in Libya, by backing the opposition to Muammar Gaddafi, we could wind up with another, radical Islamic government in the Middle East, the enemy, and I speak, you know, of the capital E enemy, the powers and principalities, no doubt would dearly love to have. Even if chemical weapons were used inside of Syria, by the way, how do we know that it was Assad's forces? I mean, if Al-Qaeda is actually, you know, battling for control of chemical weapons plants inside of Syria, as the Telegraph is reporting, how do we know they haven't already taken some stores or stockpiles away from the Assad regime and used them? The information that comes to us is filtered through various news sources, each with a particular editorial slant, which newspapers have always had, which is why so many of them are named the Republican or the Democrat or the Independent or whatever. So we're just trying to do the best we can to see through the fog. Make no claims of accuracy, at least on this score. All we know is that, according to prophecy, someday there's big war coming to the Middle East. And whether it's today or 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, we don't know.
Well, you know, I want to shift gears for a minute. And right after the marathon bombing, there was a huge fire in Texas. And the past couple of days, we've seen another couple of stories. A refinery in Detroit. Big explosions happened there, I think it was today. Mm-hmm. And then massive explosions down in Mobile, Alabama.
even overseas, big explosion in Prague.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that one.
That one, they believe, just a gas leak. But
you know, it's really hard to know if there are bad actors, to mm-hmm. use that little quote, that little phrase from Washington, that are out there trying to, well, make us afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that gets to the point that I wanted to get to, because after the bombing in Boston, and again, as a false flag, how effective, and I don't mean to diminish the pain and suffering caused to the people who were too close to the pressure cookers, mm-hmm. But there were three fatalities, unlike 9/11, in which there were, many, many more.
Right.
Numbers of other incidents where considerably more loss of life.
Right.
Again, and that's not to take anything, diminish or take anything away from those who suffered greatly as a result of those explosions. But as a false flag, how effective is that really?
Well, wasn't there shortly after 9/11, I think it was 2 or 3 years later, we started seeing stories that Al-Qaeda had essentially decided that the big events were not real. All they did was bring us together. So they decided to just have lots of little events, lots of little terrorist acts, the way you've seen in Great Britain with the IRA, the way you've seen in Israel with, the Palestinians. it is scary. If I thought that, especially when we had Nicole as a little girl, mm-hmm. if I thought that going to Walmart or going to her band performance might end up with an explosion, it would be really hard to go out there and do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I get nervous enough going on long, automobile trips simply because I've been in a number of automobile crashes.
Yeah. And we did see some very interesting reactions from American politicians, including Senator Rand Paul, who had that, who mounted that filibuster,
mm-hmm.
Against the confirmation of the, was the new director of the CIA, because of his stand on the Obama administration's stand on the potential use of drones against American citizens. And he kind of backtracked a little bit from that statement after the Boston bombing and allowed us how, drones might actually serve some use in law enforcement. So that was one interesting result or consequence of the bombings in Boston. And a lot of fans of Ron Paul are really upset at the change of direction by Rand Paul following the bombing at the Boston Marathon.
It's a strange thing. Washington is, it's an odd bipolar city in some ways, because on the one hand you'll get people discussing that we need to make illegal immigrants legal by passing some sort of major legislation. There are also others at the same time, and sometimes the very same people, saying it's people who come in for student visas and immigrants that come in from other countries that we really need to start profiling.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have them both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never did quite figure out what the of course, bringing in the FBI and the CIA brings up the question, did they know about the Tsarnaev brothers, two years ago?
And what did they know and when did they know it?
Yeah. Well,
for example, Russia and officials claim that they tipped off the FBI. And the FBI admits that, we interviewed these guys a couple of years ago. We closed the case on it because we couldn't find any reason to, hold them or charge them or deport them.
But the gentleman that they're saying now, I think a Russian immigrant, who is supposedly, what is the word they use? It's the word they use when you turn them into a terrorist.
Radicalized.
Radicalized. Yeah, Thank you very much. Supposedly he had radicalized them. Well, he's been on their radar, the CIA radar, for a long time.
Yeah. And because we talked about this a number of times. We've talked about this past week. What this probably will lead to are ultimately more restrictions on what you can do on the internet. Because these guys, well, they're using the internet to be radicalized.
Exactly.
They're self-radicalizing.
Johnny, get out of the bathroom and self-radicalize. Stop self-radicalizing.
Yeah. What really interesting development. You mentioned that DNA women, DNA of a woman was found on some of the shrapnel recovered from the blast site.
Yes, let me find the little story.
I thought that was kind of an interesting bit of news. The question is then.
It's an article at the Wall Street Journal. Investigators have found female DNA on at least one of the bombs used in the Boston Marathon attacks. Hmm. Now, I'm wondering, how did they do that? Was this an unexploded device? My understanding is that
there weren't any unexploded devices found.
And even originally, they claimed there was a claim that they had found one or two that had not been exploded, and that they exploded them safely. Mm-hmm. So, how do you find female DNA that has been essentially cooked? Because DNA denatures when it gets really hot.
Well, that was a question I had, and as someone who's studied the molecule far more in depth, I wondered about that. Is there any way that they could tell whether that DNA was there before it exploded, or if it was sadly after a piece that
I don't know. I assume that if the story is true, that we will find someone who matches that DNA profile. I think it is assumed. My little microphone just keeps moving. It's gone squishy. One assumption at this point could be that it's Tamerlan Tsarnaev's wife, surviving wife, his widow, who may, because I think they shared the same apartment, rather squalid apartment from what I understand, but if she indeed did share a life with him, then it's very likely that his clothing could have had, you know, her hair on it. He could have had some of her skin cells, you know, on his. It's really difficult to say how it got there, and I think if it does turn out to be hers, she has a good defense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as you said, though, DNA denatures and at the high temperatures you'd assume would result from a bomb exploding. You just wonder, you know, how they'd be able to tell.
I don't know. It could be that I don't know. Yeah. All I know is that it doesn't like high temperatures very much.
Interesting. Well, of course, you know, the fear gets ratcheted up. I mean, there was a bike tour in New York City today, and participants in the 5-borough bike tour were told that they were not allowed backpacks or hydration packs or saddlebags. Next Sunday's bike tour, by the way, it's coming up next Sunday. They can wear small fanny packs, bring water bottles, and bike frame bags, but anything large enough to store an explosive banned.
This really has nothing to do with terror, so to speak, but it really is part of what you and I discuss very frequently on PID Radio, and that is the supernatural and various fringe groups that like to engage with the supernatural. Mm-hmm. On April 24th, there was an article that was out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where the TSA agents found pottery in luggage that had human skull fragments embedded in the pottery.
Oh, really?
The luggage belonged to a Santeria priestess who was traveling to the United States for a course of some kind that she was taking, religious training. Oh, no, sorry. She was returning from Cuba, where she had been attending a religious training event. She was at a seminar. And apparently she had picked up these, pots, and they are, she said, for quote-unquote, protection. They had human skull fragments in them. So, that's pretty weird.
Santeria is, it's a syncretized religion of West African, Caribbean, and Roman Catholicism.
Yeah. Well, wasn't it the manager for the White Sox?
Yes, Ozzie Guillen.
Practiced, and he was very public about practicing.
Yeah. Venezuelan fellow who went on to manage one season with the Florida Marlins before they tossed him over the side.
Very strange. But you know, speaking of airports, there are airports in China that are very serious about implementing the same sort of checkpoints that were in place during the SARS epidemic because of the H7N9 very small outbreak that's taking place in China. But the problem is that it's got about a 20 to 30% mortality rate.
Really?
This is a very bad bug.
20 to 30%. That's higher than some estimates gave the Spanish flu.
Much higher. I think I've often seen the highest estimate is about 5% on that
one. Spanish flu?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty deadly.
How transmissible is it?
Well, that's the big question. China is saying that no, it seems to be coming from markets where you go to buy chickens or ducks. They are saying it is not human-human transmissible. However, if they are checking you at the airport, then there must be something up. If you talk to Henry Nyman or read any of his articles at his website, recombinomics.com, you'll find out that Henry Nyman believes that it is human-human transmissible based on two family clusters that he's been following. And his reasoning is when patient one in a family gets sick and patient two doesn't get sick until 10 days later, and more than likely, patient two caught it from patient one. So if this is human-to-human transmissible, it's bad. And I think one of the really big problems with H7N9 is that there appear to be possibilities that some folks won't show symptoms. So having checkpoints at the airport may not help you because, you know, Johnny, you know, come lately, who's getting on the plane from China bound for New York may not be symptomatic until he gets
home
to New York.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's no way to really stop that or watch that unless you hold people at the airport in quarantine for, you know, the
10 days
the incubation
or 2 weeks
is, sure,
or whatever it is. Huh. There's also a question mark as to whether or not some people are carriers. They never show symptoms. And the reason they think this is because out of a large group of people in the areas where this outbreak is taking place, they have randomly done blood checks and found that the virus is in the bloodstreams of some people who are not sick at all.
Well, that's depressing. Now, H7N9, how is that different from an H5N1 or?
Well, the H stands for hemagglutinin, and the N stands for neuraminidase, I think. Those are just proteins that are on the virus that have different genetic codes. Something has changed within the DNA or within the RNA, depends on the virus, within the code for that protein. And it's somehow changed the formation of it a little bit that it can either grab onto you or it can't. H7N9 apparently has a strong affinity for lung tissue in humans. The people that are getting very sick and other organs, the people that are getting sick, they have multiple organ failure.
Ooh.
It's very similar to H1N1.
How many deaths reported so far, do you know?
The last time I checked, and that was several days ago, it was 22, 23, and about 200 people were sick, they thought. And again, that I know doesn't sound like 20% mortality rate, but that's what they're reporting. So clearly China's numbers aren't matching what, you know, the various news outlets are saying. I think the bottom line here is China is very loath to tell us the truth, and you can understand why, because they have a lot of Westerners who go in and out. They depend upon Western trust. And if we thought that there was a huge outbreak of a very deadly virus over there,
we might stop doing
you and
business.
I wouldn't travel there.
Yes,
exactly.
We might stop doing business in China. Yeah,
exactly.
Suddenly Walmart finds another country to make its stuff.
Well, you never know. I don't think that would happen for a long time. But China, there, you know, years ago when I was originally researching the Spanish flu for a teleplay that I was writing a long time ago, mm-hmm. I found various articles that I tell you have now disappeared from the internet. But these articles indicated that the earliest versions of those that virus that struck in 1918-1917 had actually struck a few years earlier in India and China.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the question is, and my question has always been, was that virus perhaps created or changed a little, tweaked in a lab?
Mm-hmm. Would the technology have existed to do that during pre-World War
I? Well, not to the extent it does now. I don't think that. But the truth is, if you get kids in a sandbox, they're going to play if they think that they can do it. The truth is that DNA has been studied, that what they called nucleic acids that were called colored bodies. That's what chromosome means. It means colored body. Hmm. They were observed in in microscopes 150 years ago. Long time. So for a long time, scientists have been studying these strange little squiggly things inside of the nucleus. In 1918, maybe, because you and I often say that what we're told in the news that science knows how to do today probably was being practiced and tested in a lab 20 to 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. True. It makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Because it was officially not discovered until Crick and Watson in, 1940?
No. They DNA? Knew about DNA prior to that. They discovered the actual structure of it.
Gotcha. Okay. So DNA was known.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able to take it apart and reassemble it, you think, in 1917, 1918?
Well, they might have tried. I mean, if they had discovered restriction enzymes, which is how you do gene splicing, if they had accidentally somehow come across that, they might have figured out a way to do it. But it could have been nothing more than, I'm going to expose this duck to this pig, this, you know, chicken, to this dog, and put a human in there.
Yeah. Sort of the same thought process is, let's just take this blanket from this person who died of the pox and throw it over the wall.
Well, exactly. That was biowarfare.
Exactly. And there's some really interesting stories about this, the Spanish flu, disturbing, actually, from World War I era that was at Camp Funston in, was it Funston in Kansas?
In Fort Riley?
Fort Riley. Was apparently ground zero here in the United States for the disease. But
well,
how did it get
there?
That's
the official story. The official story is that there was a cook who was out cleaning out the horse stalls.
Yeah.
And as he was doing so, he described it, or the journals from the time described it, as sort of a yellow dust storm came up. And he was, you know, inundated by the dust storm. He went in, he prepared the food, and got sick that evening. Mm-hmm. And before the week was out, nearly everybody was sick.
Right. And the odd thing about the Spanish flu, and I'm curious to know how this new H7N9 is affecting different age groups. The thing about the Spanish flu was that it was much deadlier to people in the prime of life, people in their 20s and 30s. Do I remember that correctly?
That is true.
That normally they say it's very young and the very old who are the prime victims of influenza. But in 1918, 1919, it was mostly people in their 20s and 30s who were dying from it.
Right. I don't know that there is a large enough pool of people who have contracted the disease, and particularly those who have died from it, yet to make that generalization. But the ones that I've read about seem to be, you know, just parents probably in their 30s and children.
The theory, if I remember correctly, wasn't the theory that the disease caused the body's own
immune system
to attack itself, and that's why people with the strongest immune systems, people in the prime of life.
That theory exists about H7N9 as well.
Okay, just curious.
And H7N9 is a kind of a weird syncretic virus in that it's got pieces from a lot of different things, and that often happens. That is recombination. If virus A starts out in a pig and then gets infected into a chicken, or vice versa, it'll pick up little pieces from the DNA here and there. DNA is not a stable configuration. It's constantly switching around. They're called transposons.
I see. We'll switch from A flat to...
That's funny. That transpose on also called jumping genes.
I see.
Yeah, they jump around.
Hmm.
And sometimes they do that because they're switching a gene off or on.
Well, I know...
Or a gene autry.
We've talked about influenza, and we've interviewed Dr. Henry Nyman. If he was one of our first interviews, in fact, on PA Radio back in 2005.
And he's so hard to get now. He is busy, busy, busy man. And I think part of it is because his company is pretty successful.
Yeah.
Good for him.
And so, you know, as we've discussed and talked about this particular issue for some time now, it can almost begin to sound like, sounding the same false alarm over and over again.
It can.
But as we look at these, we're just trying to be, again, it's not for the purpose of trying to spread fear, but just to be aware of what's going on in other parts of the world. And you know, just a reminder that none of us is guaranteed another day. I mean, the fact is that this H7N9 may never, ever cross the ocean from China to the United States, may never spread across Asia and into Europe or wherever you happen to be listening to this. It may never become more than just a very localized phenomenon.
Right.
But we are told in Scripture that at some point there will be as things break down and as we enter that period where God releases his judgment upon the earth and you know, in our interpretation or understanding of eschatology, we believe that by that point, those who have faith in Christ Jesus will be out of here. But things could get really bad as far as pestilence is concerned, spreading around the world. And there are those who suffer from it regardless in places that, in Africa in particular, but other places around the world that are impoverished, where people don't have the access to medicines that we have here in the United States. We complain about the cost of our health insurance and our health coverage, but the fact is we still have access, for the most part, to the best medicine in the world. There are people on the other side of the world who would dearly love to just have a bottle of painkiller,
yeah.
You know, aspirin, which we take for granted.
That is so true. Well, you asked how many have died so far. I did a quick search while you were saying those wonderful things, very true things, in fact, about eschatology. And, the fact is that it doesn't go from 0 to 60 from, you and I think we both at least believe in a pre-wrath rapture.
Yeah.
It doesn't go from 0 to 60 when the church is out of here. Jesus makes it very clear, prophecy makes it very clear that it gets progressively worse the closer we get to that event.
Mm-hmm.
So we may well see, terrible plagues between now and then. Definitely in that last 7-year period, there will be, especially in the latter 3.5 years, there will be some horrific plagues that take out as much as a third of the population at a time. But back to this, it says here that 24 patients have now died, but the World Health Organization is on record. They literally released statements saying that H7N9 was one of the most lethal influenza viruses ever.
Hmm. And again, if they're saying that it's deadlier than the Spanish flu, just remember that in 1919, when the population of the world was much lower than it is today, estimates range as high as 50 to 200 million deaths from the Spanish flu.
In fact, when you look at a graph of world population, there is a very sharp dip down at 1918.
Yeah. Very, very strange. I've got scanned copies of letters that my grandfather wrote back home from the front close enough to the front that they actually had some German biplanes and triplanes, fly overhead and try to, drop bombs on the motor pool.
That's
company
close
that he worked
enough.
For. Close enough. But Grandpa closed all of his letters with the SIG line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like they had computers back then. I am feeling fine and am in the best of health. Your loving son, Eskel. And I'm like, feeling fine and the best. Why did he put that on there? I mean, I love my mom, but I wouldn't bother to write that on every note, from camp or whatever. But then it dawned on me that he was writing those letters in the fall of 18 and the spring of 19 when the Spanish flu was rampant. So, yeah, that's as close as it came to touching my family as far as I know, but it clearly showed that they were aware of it, I'm guessing. So,
how are we doing on time?
We're just about at the 1-hour mark. So,
well, before we close out, I want to make sure that we mention the passing of a dear friend and colleague,
yes,
Sue Bradley, who has been just such a valiant researcher and writer in the last, 10 years. She's been writing for much longer than that, but we've only gotten to know her in the last 10 years or so. Not even that long, actually, in the last 5 to 7, because how long have we been doing this show?
8 years.
Maybe longer than that. Yeah, well, yeah, we're in our 9th year. So we met her a couple of years after we started this, and she and I shared many wonderful telephone conversations. She would call me up, and Sue had some health issues for most of her life over the last decade or two, and stemming from, other health issues. But anyway, she had visiting nurses oftentimes, and she had some issues with her eyes that made it difficult to walk from one space to another without feeling dizzy. And so she had a difficult time, honestly, sitting and staring at a computer screen for very long. And when she would come across something that she felt really was laid on her heart to talk to me about, she would put a little post-it note. And she would call and she said, you'd laugh if you saw this. She said, "You, I've got post-it notes all over this room." And she said, "I'm not sure which one goes for you." And so she would go from one to the other and she'd sort of read them out to herself. And, oh, yeah, here it is. And she would talk to me about something that had just happened in the news and what it made her think of. She wrote a number of series articles within series that we published at PID Radio, PIDnews.com, and I've published also at my website off and on. But she finally realized that she needed to keep her own archives, and so Sue Bradley, and Bradley is L-E-Y, SueBradleyArchives.com is where she started putting her articles. I don't know how many she actually finally put there, but I just found out from her husband, Pat, that Steve Quayle has stepped in and offered to publish everything that Sue ever wrote that is related to what you and I discuss here all the time.
Yeah.
Insightful lady.
Yeah, very much so. A deep thinker, and
she'll be missed. She will be missed. She was often consulted. In fact, Chris Putnam was consulting her on his most recent book, Exo Vaticana.
Yeah, and she's got some things here. There's a link to a number, again, SueBradleyArchives.com, a lot of the articles that she posted, including the Black Awakening series, The Men Who Stare at Goats, CERN, Zechariah 11, Mysterious Number 44. Just a lot of, a lot of different things here.
Mary. In fact, she's the one that even introduced me to Mary Shelley's book, The Last Man. I had never heard of it before, but it's sort of like Omega Man. Yeah, it's an interesting read, and I think it's available as a Kindle book, I think.
Yeah.
But so, lots of good ones here. You'll want to go in there and read it.
And as I understand, Pat, you had a conversation with him or exchanged an email with him.
I exchanged some email with him. He is very sure that there will be a memorial service of some kind within the next few months, and he would like to invite the many colleagues and friends who have been, part of Sue Bradley's life, or she's been a part of ours. So if you are interested in attending a memorial service for Sue Bradley, she and her husband and their son lived in the Pittsburgh area. So, and she often wrote about that, the town at the junction of three rivers and the supernatural implications thereof. But, if you're interested, please just send us a note. You can, send me a private message on Facebook. Just let us know.
Yeah.
And we will send your contact information to Pat.
We'll keep you posted on that. And, as you say, I think the best way to...
She's pain-free now. She's pain-free, finally.
And she will be missed until once again we're reunited.
Boy, that's the truth.
Yeah. Until next time.
Love you, Sue.
I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content copyright Gilbert House and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.